702. The Naked Scientist.
Time for us to connect with Dr. Chris Smith, the Naked Scientist, and we take your questions right now, any science-related questions for him on 011-883-0702. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Lovely to chat to you. And I think there's excitement in the UK seeing reports around the development of a human, almost like a robotic heart that will hopefully assist with heart transplants, but it's by the year 2028.
Oh, well, I better not have a heart attack until then. I haven't seen that story. Is that out today?
Yeah, that researchers in the UK, Cambridge and the Netherlands, they're developing a robotic heart that can pump blood through the circulatory network, but it's soft and pliable. Oh. So I was just curious about the material.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big problem, actually, replacing the heart, because obviously the heart isn't just pumping a liquid like water. It's actually pumping a fluid which has got cells in it, and the cells are vulnerable to being damaged. So you can't just put a sort of propeller in and push blood along the way normal pumps work, or just squash the blood along, because that would damage the cells and cause them to rupture. So the devices that people come up with that actually move blood around the body have to be extremely carefully engineered. Mm. And the solution that nature's arrived at, which is basically a bag that squeezes, is the best one for not traumatizing the cells and achieving an efficient movement. So why try to unstitch millions of years of evolution? Mm. You look at what nature's given you and you say, well, can we copy that and do it in a way that will be useful? But it's a serious issue. I mean, if you look at the death rates because of heart disease, about one in two people listening to this program will die of some kind of heart problem.
Mm.
So we need a way of addressing that and replacing the heart when the blood vessels become furred up and you get heart attacks and heart failure.
Yeah.
Big problem.
It is, and not to mention the waiting list.
Exactly right. And the number of people who die waiting for transplants, for example, is enormous. And this is because there's just a shortage of organs, and the shortage of compatible organs far outstripped the demand, far outstrips the supply. So yes, if we can come up with a robotic solution, that will be lovely. But
absolutely,
it's a really tough nut to crack, this one.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got a few questions ready for you, Chris. Our listeners have given us a call on 011-883-0702. Annie, we start with you. You're calling from Lanseria. Hello, Annie.
Good afternoon, Azzy.
Hi.
I'd like to say hello to Prof.
Oh, hello, Annie.
Good afternoon, Prof. Good afternoon, Prof. Prof, I'm a nursing sister. I'm a theatre sister. My question is about expiry dates or shelf life. We use consumable sutures, grafts, implants. Why is the expiry date, shelf life, but the product stays in a patient forever?
Ah, if it's an implant, okay.
Yeah, it's a very good question, this, because someone wrote to me the other day and said, why is there an expiry date on a bottle of water?
Mm-hmm.
I thought water, you know, would probably not go off. And you're absolutely right. Water, there's water on Earth that's millions of years old. The reason products have a shelf life is purely for safety, because manufacturers have tested them and they have shown that within this date and this date, they operate exactly as they have designed them. Older than that, they haven't tested them, or they have tested them and they become unsafe. So for safety reasons, we have a window period when we know we can guarantee that this thing will perform the way it's supposed to. Beyond that, we have no guarantees. Now, obviously, when it goes into a patient, for example, then that's different entirely, because we've then got clinical data for what happens when you put sutures or implants or whatever into the patient. We've followed up people for many years, and we know how the thing performs under those circumstances. So that's a different kind of sell-by date. But when things are sitting on a shelf, you've got to remember that, for instance, the packet might deteriorate. And if the packet deteriorates, maybe tiny holes will open up in the packet, and this could allow in particles, bacteria, infection, spores, other things. It might be that some chemical reaction happens between the packet and the things in the packet, which produces some kind of chemical that could produce a reaction in the body.
Mm.
So it's not as simple as saying, this seems a bit daft to just have a sell-by date on something that will then last a lifetime in a person. It's actually all about safety. And in some cases, yes, they probably are overcautious, but in other cases, it's there to make sure we don't use stuff that could be unsafe.
Right. So if it is something that's going inside the human body, maybe breast implants or, as you said, sutures and things like that, we've just tested and proven that they can and they won't lose their efficacy while they're within the body.
Once they're in the body, it's a different situation,
right?
Because they're in the body and they're now your problem. But when they're sitting on the shelf of the operating theatre, until they're used, they're the manufacturer's problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're saying, this is reliable, this is clinically safe, this is clinically proven. Once you take it out of the packet and put it into somebody, then it's been tested in the clinical context, in the body, in a different way,
right,
and for a different period of time. And so that's a different question. And there will obviously be a lifetime. We know that with, say, certain implants and things, manufacturers say, well, you can expect this to last this long.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might have to replace it. A hip replacement is a very good example. We know that if you treat your hip replacement carefully, it will last you a lot longer than if you put it into someone who's a lot more active, a lot younger, or maybe someone who's a lot heavier, mm-hmm, and they might wear it out sooner. So it comes down to whose concern it is and whose fault it is if something goes wrong at the different stages of the process.
Okay. Next, let's go to Ivan calling from Pretoria. Ivan, you have a question about the coronavirus.
Hi, good afternoon, Chris. Hi, Ivan. Quick one. How are you? China seems to be taking this very, very seriously. If you do a simple extrapolation, if 1 billion people get coronavirus, 50 million people could die. Where are we going with this? It just seems to be quite a serious virus, because even the guys at Davos are talking about it. Gold prices are going up, so it seems to be quite serious. And what is our treatment? Do we self-medicate? Do we stay at home and get antibiotics? And think about the worst-case scenario for Africa. Where are we?
Mm. Ivan?
A lot of people are saying the same thing, Ivan, actually, to you, and saying, well, hang on a minute. Why are China going all full steam ahead on this? Why are they building 2 new hospitals with 1,000 beds, at least, in 2 weeks?
Mm.
Why are they closing down whole parts of the country with millions of people in them, unless they have evidence that this is really quite serious?
Yeah.
Now, I think that the thing about China is that they're never as open with their information, or we always take it with a pinch of salt, because we have had instances in the past where they haven't been entirely honest, or they haven't given all of the facts up front. One also has to be cautious about the reporting, because what we're told is what we're given, and you know what is disseminated in the media is what information is provided.
Mm.
And at the moment, the Chinese are providing the information, and that's going to be retrospective, because when they're testing, the numbers take time to process, and the tests take time to process, and then the information comes out, and then it goes into the media.
Mm.
So it's always out of date. And also, the testing hasn't been running for that long, because we didn't know what the agent was, and then we didn't know what to test for to find that agent. Now we do, but obviously you've got to catch up.
Yeah.
So there's a lag in how much information is being provided. There's a lag in terms of whether we trust the information completely that's being provided, and I suspect it's probably more serious in China than they're letting on at the moment, but that's just my personal speculation. And one is never complacent with new infections. This is a brand new infection. It's come out of the animal world and jumped into the human race, and one never knows exactly how it's going to behave until we have big numbers to look at and we can see the trajectory, and we're still gathering that data at the moment. So people are being cautious, and they're taking relevant steps to protect themselves in all countries around the world that I'm aware of, and those include making sure you know where people are coming from when they come into your country, and warning people if they have any of these symptoms, this is what they must do, having a policy in place to follow up those people if they do develop symptoms and to trace contacts, having provision of isolation facilities if you need to isolate people promptly. And so all these things are being done at the moment. And we do have some benefit of hindsight, because this happened previously with a severe acute respiratory syndrome outbreak in 2002-03, and it was a near identical situation. So people are using and dusting off the information about that and the guidelines they drew up and the processes they drew up and the protocols they were using, and they're redeploying those things. And we're just now watching and waiting to see how this is going to shift. And we're also reliant on China to be open with the information, so we know whether our responses in our countries are going to be proportionate.
Yeah, we've introduced the heat scanners for incoming passengers, of course, and there are other measures, of course, that several countries have taken around the world. And the death toll has gone up, and also the rates of infection have gone up. The numbers, you know, as you said, though, Chris, the problem is that this is retrospective. So there's cause for concern, considering that it's infectious for 14 days, from what some of the reports are saying. And that's ample time for someone to skip, hop, and end up in and come across hundreds of people.
Mm. Well, we were originally thinking it was about a one-week incubation. This class of viruses may incubate for as long as 2 weeks. Mm. And the other question that's outstanding is, well, at what point in that incubation period do you actually become productively infectious? In other words, if you hang around with people, at what point is there a higher likelihood that they're going to catch it from you? Because when you first catch a disease, although you may be detectable as carrying that disease, the amount of virus that's shedding from your body is going to be much lower than when you become really grossly symptomatic and really ill later. So the threat that you pose is going to change with time. And as we get more information and we get more people to study, we'll be able to understand more about how this performs, this disease. But at the moment, it's very much wild speculation.
Yeah, and we're actually working on a masterclass around pandemics soon. So, Ivan, something to look forward to on the station. Thank you very much for your call. Andy in Germiston, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mom. I have a small question to ask the medical scientists.
Yeah.
Do we have any scientific reason why people's voice do change when they are drunk?
Okay, this is what you've observed. The voice changes. In what way? Does it become deeper, louder?
You know, when they are drunk, their voice are not normal again. You know, they speak slowly the voice changed completely.
Okay. Any thoughts on that, Chris? What causes that?
Are we talking just about people when they drink alcohol, or are we talking about all kinds of circumstances?
Well, he's confining it to when they're drunk.
Okay. The reason for this is there's actually a number of aspects to this. Speaking is probably the most complicated motor movement that a person has to make.
Wow.
Because you've got to coordinate so many muscle groups and so many different processes all at once and get the timing absolutely perfect to make it work, that it's really easy to throw a spanner in the works.
Is that why I feel exhausted at the end of the show, Chris? I feel tired afterwards.
It's because you're working so hard.
Yeah.
But it's actually you've hit the nail on the head, because it's the cognitive aspect to it. In speaking, what you've got to do is listen to what someone says to you, decode the information that's come in, work out what they've said, and then work out how you're going to respond.
Mm.
And that means you've got to compile the spoken response, select the words in your brain that you're going to use, then begin to put your muscles of your face and your tongue and your throat into the right position, get your breath ready, so you've taken a breath and you're delivering air up your vocal over your vocal folds, which introduce the vibrations, and then you've got to make this very complicated sequence of movements of all of the above, the face, the tongue, the mouth, everything else, gesticulate with your hands at the same time to add emotion and add emphasis. All of these things are really, really demanding, and the timing has to be perfect.
Wow.
Now, when we drink alcohol, what it does is it potentiates the action of inhibitory nerve chemicals in the brain, one in particular called GABA.
Mm-hmm.
And when you activate this signal, it damps down the activity of different groups of nerve cells in the brain. So when you drink alcohol, you make your brain a bit less responsive, which means it can take longer to get cells to fire when they should be firing. So alcohol tends to disrupt the timing in the brain,
mm-hmm.
and because speech and the execution and creation of speech is so dependent on accurate timing, if you mess up the timing, then the speech doesn't run properly, and you can hear it because people either speak more slowly and deliberately to compensate, or they end up with the speech not executing it the right way, so the words slur or come out wrong or get really drawn out because the person's trying to compensate because they can hear it going wrong as they're talking. So then a mechanism to correct it kicks in, but that doesn't work properly either, and the whole thing goes off kilter. And then there's the whole kind of, because alcohol is also a depressant and it makes you feel sleepier, it's much harder to think straight when you're sleepy. So the word selections and the construction of your sentences tends to deteriorate as well. So the whole thing just degenerates. And in the end, it's not worth trying to have a conversation with someone because all they're going to tell you is that they're your best mate and they love you.
I know, it's just not worth it, Chris. I've often stood there listening to someone who's been drinking and thinking, why am I wasting minutes of my life standing here and listening to this drunk person continue to repeat themselves and share nonsensical story? Thank you for that explanation. It's just brilliant. Sean in Greenstone, hi.
Hi, afternoon, Daniel and Chris. Yeah, you touched on the heart earlier, and you gave us that 1 in 2 people will die of heart disease, which is the last thing I needed to hear, because I'm extremely paranoid about my heart giving in one day. I suffer with tendonitis to my shoulder, so I get pains, and I constantly think I'm having a heart attack. But I'd just like to find out from Chris, is there any really good test you can go for? I am relatively young, and what can you kind of do on a monthly basis just to kind of keep an eye on your heart to make sure that it is functioning in the best way possible?
Hi, Sean. Yeah, this is a very important question, because what we know is that we've become really very good at saving lives from heart attacks, but what we've become very bad at is then turning people into cardiac invalids, where people then have the damage caused by a heart attack and they're alive, but they have a poor quality of life because they suffer with heart failure, which limits their exercise capacity and their ability to have a healthy, happy life. So what we'd really like to do is stop people having a heart attack or a stroke, which is also a vascular problem caused by the same thing that causes heart attacks in the first place. So people are now beginning to build a lot of data around what predicts heart attacks and heart attack risk. One of the simplest measures is family history. If you have people in your family who have had heart disease themselves and they're your first degree relatives, then you have a much higher likelihood of that happening to you. If you've got someone who has a heart attack at a very young age, for example, and by young age I mean in your, say, 30s and 40s, and even in your early 50s, then that would be considered a seriously bad family history. That's one useful pointer. The second one is you can then ask, well, we know the risk factors for heart disease. The number one risk factor, apart from family history, is smoking. If a person smokes, they dramatically increase their risk of having a heart attack or stroke. So if you don't do that, your risk is automatically a lot lower. Then your cholesterol level, because cholesterol is one component of the blood system which builds up in the walls of arteries and furs them up. And the higher the cholesterol level of a bad form of cholesterol called LDL, the greater the risk that your arteries are going to fur up. Then there's blood pressure. People who have a higher blood pressure are stressing their arteries more, and they're more likely to damage the wall of the arteries and make it more likely that they'll fur up. And then there are things like lifestyle factors, exercise, obesity, risk factors like diabetes and so on. So when you go to a doctor, they'll look at all of these sorts of things, and they can now predict a coronary risk score for that person, and then they have a better idea as to who to keep an eye on or not. And then we're also now beginning to develop techniques where you can begin to spot the risk areas of blood vessels. And a colleague of mine here in Cambridge has developed this chemical which you can put into the bloodstream, and it's actually very similar to toothpaste. You don't inject a whole tube of toothpaste in your blood vessels, obviously, but what it does is it goes into the wall of the artery and flags up the areas that might become a blockage that would cause a heart attack. And so then you know where to focus your attention and treat people with these sorts of things. So a range of different measures are now coming in to protect people.
Chris, always a pleasure. There's still so many other questions we didn't get to, the WhatsApp ones and so on. But we have another opportunity next week, God willing. Thank you.
Let's hope we haven't all succumbed to Wuhan City virus by then.
Fingers crossed. Thank you, Chris.
Take care. Bye-bye.